The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated April 26/May 3, 2021. Climate is Everything is the headline, How the Pandemic Can Lead Us to a Better, Greener World. And Time is in large capital block lettering on white. The border, as usual, of the front cover is in red. The word Time and the headline phrase are superimposed on a gray background, upon which are the outlines of the continents of the world in a two-dimensional space. Luca Locatelli, Red Hong Yi, and Annis Lin created this cover art. Artist Red Hong Yi created the image out of 50,000 matchsticks to represent how the climate crisis connects us all, emphasizing perhaps the negative aspects of climate change. Each of the continents is ablaze in some corner, or even in the center of one of the continents. Beginning with this article within the View section, and beneath that, Nation, and beneath that is the title, Optimism is in the Air, by Charlotte Alter. On an April day in Manhattan, Erin Fox emerged from the giant glass building where she had gotten her first dose of the Pfizer vaccine. The Javits Center, and that's spelled J-A-V-I-T-S, and Pfizer is spelled P-F-I-Z-E-R. The Javits Center, home to comic book confabs and one highly dramatic presidential non-victory, had become a key hub of a New York City vaccination effort, inoculating close to 100,000 people a day. It was now operational nirvana, said Fox, a vice president of operations for Kaplan North America, who was in and out with her shot in under half an hour. Walking into the afternoon sun, Fox felt surprisingly emotional, almost like back-to-school jitters. It was finally warm enough to loosen her jacket. It's like the COVID spring, she says. It's poetic that people are getting vaccinated just as spring is coming. And spring is a symbol of emerging from the dark COVID winter. A year ago in New York, sirens blared day and night as the city became the epicenter of the nation's battle against the disease. Streets were empty. Restaurants were deserted. A hospital ship was docked not far from the Javits Center. A temporary field hospital was built in Central Park, where the trees are now starting to bloom. America is not past the pandemic yet. Dangerous variants of the virus are circulating. Lockdown fatigue has caused anxiety, depression, or burnout. More than 550,000 Americans are dead. Millions have lost loved ones, and the effects of the pandemic are still reverberating through communities of color that were hardest hit. And yet it is undeniable that green shoots are beginning to pop up everywhere. From vaccination rates to new jobs added, the pace and scale of the recovery have outstripped even the rosiest projections. One in four U.S. adults is now fully vaccinated, and every adult in America should have become eligible for the vaccine by April 19. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the U.S. is now administering an average of around 3 million shots a day and has delivered more vaccine doses than any other nation on Earth. Meanwhile, the economy added 916,000 jobs in March, smashing expectations and bringing the unemployment rate down to 6%. I have probably never been as confident about the outlook as I have been today, says Mark Zandi, the chief economist at Moody's Analytics, who predicts the next 6 to 18 months are going to be rip-roaring. It's going to be gangbusters growth. The optimism has pervaded even the industries most affected by the pandemic. Airline leaders believe more Americans will be eager to travel as vaccinations increase. The theater industry is preparing for a big comeback, with a jump in ticket sales and dozens of new shows preparing to open on Broadway later this year. Restaurants are still struggling to break even, but business looks much better than it did a year ago. America's finally coming out of a period of collective hibernation, clawing its way back into the sun after one of the longest, darkest winters anybody can remember. We are emerging from our cramped, dark isolation to blink at the fresh new world that awaits. Save the dates for rescheduled weddings are appearing in mailboxes. Baseball stadiums are beginning to fill up. Vacations are being planned. Grandparents are finally hugging their grandchildren. This spring is also a time for new beginnings. A year of rumination has forced many Americans to rethink their frenzied pre-COVID routines, moving to new cities, launching new careers, building new relationships, and considering how to spend their working hours. It is not yet clear how permanent these changes will be. The buzz are only just emerging after all. But after a nationwide trauma, Americans are reimagining how they want to live. Many of the newly vaccinated New Yorkers streaming out of the Javits Center were busy making more immediate plans. Fashion designer Rita De La Rosa, 50, said she intended to visit her parents in the Dominican Republic and her children in Florida. Carol DeSanto, 62, who survived COVID-19 early last year, said she couldn't wait to go to a concert at Jones Beach. Tuscany Fusar, 24, said he was excited to finally meet up with my Tinder and Hinge matches. It is almost symbolic. We were in the dark and in the cold, and now it's new life and new beginnings, says Tim Berner, 29, who got his second vaccine dose in early April. It is a renaissance. This article was written by Charlotte Alter, and there's a small photograph tucked between a couple of columns of text. Masked New Yorkers stroll past cherry blossom trees blooming in Central Park in early April. Well, one person is stripped down to a sundress with sandals, and she's marching along, and the others are all wearing jackets that are shown in the photograph. One has a backpack slung over her black long-sleeved T-shirt or sweater, and she's wearing black pants, and another has dark blue pants and a long sleeve shirt and a blue vest. She's got earbuds in her ears. They're all wearing masks. One in the background, whose body and face I can't see, is lugging behind him or herself a suitcase of some kind. There's a statue off to the side on the grassy lawn. It is green. There are skyscrapers in the background, but they're mostly hidden by the trees that are blooming with cherry blossoms. Short reads, three short items here. Skepticism among soldiers. Too many troops have opted out of vaccines, write Representative Seth Moulton, Democrat, Massachusetts, and Marine Corps War College Professor Tammy S. Schultz. If we allow disinformation to cloud the judgment of service members and erode their trust in science, we will not be ready for the next fight. a belief in the power of protest. Mimi Ai, A-Y-E, a Burmese-British food writer, says fear has defined the lives of her relatives in Myanmar, but now she's hopeful. What has finally broken the dam of fear for me and for so many others, and why we are fighting so hard to support the revolution, is seeing a real chance for freedom. What counts as a violent crime? It is not a neutral category, writes a pattern of violence author, David Allan Sklansky, that's Sklansky. The blurry line between violent and nonviolent crimes has been an open invitation to racial bias by law enforcement and the criminal justice system. Another short item here, Nation is the heading, a service presidency. Amid the worst public health crisis in our lifetime, President Biden has signed the largest investment in national service in decades. The American Rescue Plan includes $1 billion for national service. That is a significant step, but it is not enough to achieve a long-term recovery for our economy or our democracy. Biden has a chance to make national service the cornerstone of his legacy. National service can provide economic opportunity while preserving the planet, creating a more informed public that rejects misinformation and demagoguery, and strengthening the cohesion of the American citizenry and people who serve advance professionally. As I learned in my 34 years in the U.S. Army, service teaches you to focus more on the things you have in common with others and less on the differences. A service presidency for the 21st century can not only rescue our economy and restore civility, but also usher in a new generation of leaders ready to tackle whatever crisis we face next. That short article was by former Army General Stanley McChrystal, who is a co-chair of Serve America Together. There's a very small colored photograph at the bottom of this column. It is President Biden, who is stepping away from a podium after making remarks at the White House March 15. He's dressed in a dark suit, a white shirt, and probably a blue tie. It's a very small image here. The podium is front and center, behind which is a wall with draperies. It looks like gold or tan draperies, and two flags, one the U.S. flag on a standard, and the other is unknown to me. I don't know if it's the presidential flag. It is on a standard, and because of the folds, I cannot determine what the emblem is. Next, the risk report, R-I-S-K, not wrist, risk. Troubling Times for Northern Ireland by Ian Bremmer. In recent weeks, Molotov cocktails, bricks, and bottles have met barricades and water cannons as towns and cities in Northern Ireland faced some of their worst rioting in years. Mobs made up mainly of teenagers from both loyalist and Republican neighborhoods have clashed with police, who struggled to keep both sides apart at a peace line, that's P-E-A-C-E, line in Belfast. The anger in Northern Ireland has many sources. Loyalists who want to remain part of the UK want to know why, in a time of COVID restrictions, authorities pursued no prosecutions after crowds defied lockdown rules to gather for the recent funeral of a prominent member of the Irish Republican Army. A police crackdown on criminal gangs in loyalist neighborhoods has also pushed defiant young people into the streets. But underneath all of this is the growing fear among loyalists that Brexit will increase the likelihood of Northern Ireland's leaving the UK to reunify with the Irish Republic, a member of the EU. The controversy of the moment centers on the question of borders. As part of Brexit negotiations with the EU, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson agreed to avoid reimposition of the land border that separates Ireland from Northern Ireland, and therefore the EU from Britain. Instead, the two sides agreed on the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol, which establishes a trade boundary in the Irish Sea. There is still haggling to be done over the movement of food, animals, and plants across that boundary to ensure that products leaving the UK meet EU legal, regulatory, and health standards. There are also outstanding questions ranging from the future of steel and aluminum tariffs to the movement of pets across the border. The EU had argued that an alignment of standards on the manufacture of many products would mean fewer and faster border checks. But Johnson's government's reluctant to make commitments that make it harder for the UK to sign future trade deals with other countries. All of this leaves loyalists in Northern Ireland feeling pushed to the European side and fearful of a unified Ireland, while facing product shortages as new customs processes slow the movement of goods. This surge of anger comes as the governing and staunchly loyalist Democratic Unionist Party, DUP, preps for a serious electoral challenge next year to fend off criticism that the DUP, supporters of Brexit, is responsible for Northern Ireland's current predicament. Its leaders have demanded that the protocol be scrapped entirely. If that is not enough to blunt criticism of the party, a fragmentation of its voting bloc could leave the Northern Ireland Assembly in the hands of nationalists, led by a Sinn Féin First Minister. That's a nightmare scenario for loyalists and a serious challenge to the Good Friday Agreement, which brought peace 23 years ago. How will Johnson respond? Many in the UK have moved in favor of Brexit in recent months, easing pressure on him for bold action, and Britain's successful vaccine rollout should continue that trend. But Johnson cannot ignore Northern Ireland's troubles because they may become worse. An end to the violence will require cooperation between Loyalist and Republican leaders, the British and Irish governments, and UK and EU negotiators charged with finding a way to ease the flow of trade to limit the risk to Ireland. Don't expect quick progress, and there's no border fix that can ease tensions between those who hope for a unified Ireland and those who fear it. Help Nature Restore Balance by Paul Polman. That's P-O-L-M-A-N. He's a former CEO of Unilever and chair of social venture Imagine. Nature and climate are inextricably linked. Nature loss drives climate change and vice versa. Right now, both are in crisis. Repairing our natural climate, reversing deforestation, for example, or conserving ecosystems to sequester and store carbon, addresses both these crises. So-called natural climate solutions are one of the most important and cost-effective ways to stay on track for net zero carbon emissions by 2050, 2050. Yet they receive little attention and just 8% of public climate funding. That must change. Well-designed natural climate solutions yield multiple co-benefits, including greater biodiversity, improved watersheds, better farm outcomes, and enhanced resilience against the impacts of global warming. They also address the opportunity for more inclusive growth for the world's poor. By 2030, that's 2030, nature-positive solutions will create more than $10 trillion and 395 million jobs, which is a huge opportunity. To accelerate progress, businesses are calling on governments to work together to create a policy feedback loop to spur bolder corporate action. This must include redefining our model of growth to value natural as well as financial capital. Reversing nature loss is a crucial part of building back better. This is not just a critical opportunity, it is our only option. To Fight Climate Change, Fight for the People by Lisa P. Jackson. Jackson is Apple's VP of Environment, Policy, and Social Initiatives. When I was 8 years old, I wrote a letter asking President Nixon to do what he could to protect our planet. I did not know I would one day go on to lead the agency he founded, the Environmental Protection Agency, or build on that work at Apple. But I saw the impact pollution was having on my community, contaminating our air and water. I knew then, as I know now, that when people's health is at risk, we should do something about it. At the heart of our concern for the planet should be a concern for people. If we want to stave off the worst impacts of climate change, we will do it by bringing the communities most affected to the table and working together. Equity should be the bedrock of environmental progress. Apple's already carbon neutral for our direct emissions, and by 2030, our carbon footprint will net to zero, from our supply chain down to the energy used to charge an iPhone. To date, more than 100 Apple suppliers have committed to our 2030 goal, and we've kept equity at the center of environmental progress, for example, by working with indigenous communities in Colombia to preserve mangrove forests that store carbon, and launching an impact accelerator to support minority-owned businesses on the cutting edge of clean energy. Climate change and global inequity are far bigger problems than any one company can solve, but I'm inspired by how many are seeing that a healthy planet demands an equitable future. It's the future I wanted as an 8-year-old writing to the president. It's a future we can build together. There is a photo here. It's a little larger. It's very green. The people, there are four people working together, are in a forest. Now, some of the trunks of the trees look pretty rickety. They're falling all over, or they're entangled and intertwined and kind of raw-looking, but there's a lot of foliage and a lot of greenery. Researchers are working for Conservation International, and they're taking a soil sample to test carbon levels of mangrove trees in Bogota. Looks like there are two men and two women. They're all dressed pretty comfortably and pretty thoroughly because they are walking through a jungle and working in a jungle. And they're all wearing caps, and some are wearing sunglasses, and they're holding what look like large stem objects or branches, but apparently they are these core sample collectors. Under the heading World, the life-saving factory. Behind the scenes at the German facilities making COVID-19 vaccines for the world by Aaron Baker, Marburg, Germany, and Alice Park. And photographs are by Luca Locatelli for Time. There's a double-page photograph here, and it looks like it's blue. There aren't a lot of people, but they're moving, so they're blurry in the photograph. Maybe half a dozen people wearing icy blue jumpsuits and purple and blue gloves, and their heads are covered with this icy blue jumpsuit material, and they've got most of them are wearing glasses, which may be safety goggles, and they're wearing masks, and the background of the room is in sterile white, as well as the ceiling, as well as the frames around the windows, which one does not look out from because they're enclosed with Venetian blinds that are closed. There's equipment in this room. It looks like a lab. stainless steel cabinetry and computer screens and things that look like scales or monitors of some kind, lots of white cords connecting things, all these various components together. The caption for this photograph that, as I indicated, looks blurry and blue is an 11-minute time lapse showing the final step of production. Technicians at BioNTech's Marburg complex filter the vaccine before pumping it into bulk packages ready for shipping to a filling and labeling facility elsewhere in Germany. If you've been vaccinated for COVID-19, chances are pretty high that you're benefiting from a product made by BioNTech. The German biotech company, co-founded by a husband and wife team of scientists, developed the vaccine that became not only the first to earn authorization in the U.S. for COVID-19 in December, but also the first ever based on a new technology involving the genetic material mRNA. In interviews in December and March, co-founders Ugur Sahin and Özlem Türeci spoke about their whirlwind year and their partnership with U.S. pharmaceutical company Pfizer to test and manufacture the vaccine. Over 3 days in late March, they also opened up their new manufacturing plant to Time for the first step-by-step look at how their life-saving and potentially pandemic-ending vaccine is made. When Sahin read a scientific paper in late January 2020 describing the first identified cases of COVID-19 in Wuhan, China, it was very clear to me that this was not a local outbreak anymore, he says, and most likely the virus had already spread worldwide. He knew there was no time to waste, but BioNTech, based in Mainz, was then primarily a cancer vaccine company. After more than a decade of research and development, the company had tested its mRNA-based cancer vaccines in about 400 people, with encouraging results. They were just exploring the possibility of creating vaccines against infectious diseases, specifically an mRNA-based vaccine against flu when COVID-19 hit. Returning to a set of more photographs now, on the top left, now this is also a lab enclosed space, but the windows are open to the outside world here. The new BioNTech production facility is in a wooded valley in Marburg. No leaves are on the trees in this photo. Technicians are working in one of the prep labs, and they often spot deer roaming in the nearby forest. Lower left, now this is another lab space with lots of stainless steel equipment. None of it is recognizable to me. The thing that I could say most closely I would recognize is something that looks like an oven, but it's not an oven. It's a square is what it is, with a tall stack on top of it and some kind of device that shows temperature or pressure or something or other. But here we have Sylvia Greb working in the early stages of the process, encoding the mRNA that teaches human cells how to trigger the antibody response needed to combat the virus. And all of the people in both of these photographs are wearing those blue jumpsuits. Now to another set of photographs on the opposing page. Again, lots of stainless steel with lots of electrical outlets and cables and tubes and things that are totally unrecognizable, except it's all mounted on a huge vat or bin. Two people are working on this, and they're even wearing not blue, but white boots and purple gloves and, again, these blue jumpsuits. Top right, to keep it protected in the body, the mRNA is encased in a bubble of lipids through a process that uses pure pressurized ethanol. Because ethanol is highly explosive, Technicians must wear special static-free boots. And another photograph in the lower right. Now here is shown a table. Hands are apparent working above the table. One looks like it's holding a pair of electric scissors and cutting maybe some plastic cable or tubing. And there are more smaller scissors lying on the tabletop. And the people who are wearing the purple and blue gloves are also enrobed in these blue suits, but only their hands are shown and part of their sleeves. From start to finish, the entire manufacturing process flows through hermetically sealed plastic tubing. After the vaccine's pumped into bulk packaging, the tubes are sealed, then cut to finish the process. And there's one more photograph here. It comprises two pages. Lots of blue, lots of steel, lots of red and green because of lights on this compartment of some kind. It almost looks eerie, as if it's from a science fiction movie. And here's the caption. No people are prevalent in this photo. The machinery that acts as the heart of the vaccine manufacturing facility, regulating the flow of gas, water, electricity, wastewater, and more throughout the building in Marburg, where 400 employees working around the clock produce several million doses of the vaccine each week. And I can almost hear the buzzing or the purring or the ka-chunking of these huge machines as this liquid vaccine is being pumped through all these possibly cooling cables. It's a phenomenally mechanically engineered operation. Returning now to the text, Uger convinced all of us, including our board, colleagues, and scientific teams, that this was now our calling, and we have to follow this mission, says Turecci. At an emergency meeting, Sahin urged a 40-member team, to move with the speed of light toward the company's new goal of developing a COVID-19 vaccine. The team, which grew to more than 200, worked nights and through holidays on Project Light Speed, and after several weeks had produced 20 candidates. An unprecedented four showed promise in neutralizing the virus. There was a clear message that this has to be the priority, said Andreas Kuhn, Senior Vice President of RNA Biochemistry and Manufacturing at BioNTech. Whatever you're doing right now, kind of forget about it, because this is the most important thing now. With so little known about the new virus, the team turned to what was known about two related coronaviruses, SARS, S-A-R-S, and MERS, M-E-R-S. Soon it had a 50,000-step process for building an mRNA vaccine against the new coronavirus, SARS, CoV-2. It begins in a 50 liter, I don't know, stainless steel tank that more closely resembles a beer keg than what you might imagine to be part of a life-saving bioreactor. Inside are fragments of mRNA coding for the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, the Achilles heel of the virus that the vaccine will exploit. The entire production process happens in a hermetically sealed system with products from each stage transported to the next via a network of transparent plastic tubing. Even so, just to be safe, technicians routinely test the air in the manufacturing rooms for any extraneous bacteria or pathogens, and those working with the vaccine regularly tap each gloved finger into petri dishes filled with agar that can culture for any stray microbes that might have made their way into the facility. Because mRNA is relatively unstable, it would not survive in its raw form in the human body. In order to keep the mRNA protected, it is encased in a fatty bubble under pressurized ethanol, a highly flammable substance. The process happens in one of six 50L tanks, each in its own sealed-off room. The few people authorized to venture in and out of the rooms put on special static-free shoes to avoid generating an accidental friction spark that could set off an explosion. Five of the tanks are named for team members who were instrumental in developing the process, and the sixth is named Margaret, after the UK grandmother who was the first person to receive the vaccine. There's another almost double-page photograph here. Well, it looks like someone standing outside a large hermetically sealed room. The room is all white and stainless steel, and it has little vials marching along in a little assembly line. And there are tubes and cables and things. And the person behind these kind of hermetically sealed glove-like entries into the room for hands only is indeed wearing the blue jumpsuit and blue goggles. And the caption reads, at the fill and finish facility operated by Baxter International in Halle, 120 miles north of Marburg, technicians monitor the washing and sterilization of the vials before they're filled with vaccine, then stoppered and sealed. Once the ethanol has done its job of creating the mRNA-containing bubbles, it's filtered out. The result is then filtered several times more, eventually ending up as a milky solution that fills 10L plastic bags. That liquid is shunted to the so-called fill and finish phase, where it's purified in tanks and then squirted into sterile vials, each containing up to six doses that are shipped to clinics around the world. BioNTech currently produces 8 million doses of its vaccine every 3 to 7 days at the new Marburg facility that the company purchased from Novartis last fall. Many lab technicians, most of whom transferred to BioNTech, still wear their old lab coats with the Novartis logo, as there hasn't been time to order new ones. Ultimately, the plant will churn out 1 billion doses a year. And BioNTech's working with Pfizer, which oversaw the final human testing that resulted in the vaccine's authorization in the UK, the US, and elsewhere, to ramp up manufacturing to produce the 2.5 billion doses it committed to providing the world in 2021. Both companies are quick to point out their work is not done. Sahin and his team are also keeping an eye on new variants of the virus starting to take hold around the world and have already developed another vaccine to target those viral versions, and they plan to start testing it soon. With the success of the COVID-19 mRNA vaccine, Sahin and Turichi see mRNA technology as playing a more dominant role in treating other diseases as well, and are preparing to pick up the work on flu and cancer vaccines that was interrupted by the pandemic. By the way, when they refer to COVID-19, COVID is in caps with a hyphen and a 1-9, and mRNA is M in lowercase, RNA in uppercase. For now, the team is rightfully proud of what it's accomplished in a very busy year. This is a once-in-a-lifetime project, says Alexander Muick, director of immunomodulators at the company, who was involved in the early stages of developing the vaccine. Who can say that they're part of the solution for a pandemic? Only a few people can say that. This article, The Life-Saving Factory, was written by Aaron Baker in Marburg, Germany, and Alice Park, with photographs by Luca Locatelli for Time, and additional reporting by Julia Zorthian, New York. Under the caption, Nation, American Quandary, conspiracy theorists are winning local elections. Communities are struggling to fight back, by Vera Bergengrun. In November, Lucas Hartwell, a high school senior in Grand Blanc, Michigan, or Grand Blanc, Michigan, noticed something strange about his school district's newest board member. This is a high school senior. Amy Facinello's Twitter feed was full of apocalyptic images and skulls made of smoke. There were cryptic calls for fellow patriots and digital soldiers to join an uprising, and vows that nothing could stop what's coming. In the posts she shared, the COVID-19 pandemic was cast as a dark plot engineered by Bill Gates, while George Floyd's killing was exposed as deep state psyop. Facinello, elected that month, was now one of seven people in charge of shaping Hartwell's education. After a few hours of research, Hartwell had a name for her bizarre ideas, QAnon, and that's spelled capital Q, capital A, lowercase N-O-N. He shared her posts on social media, directing people to a Wikipedia page about the right-wing conspiracy theory, which alleges that a sinister cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophiles is running the country. But few in Grand Blanc, a town of 8,200 outside Flint, seemed as alarmed as he was. So Hartwell, 18, decided to bring up the matter at a school board meeting in January. Reading from a speech on his laptop, he addressed a Zoom audience that included Facinello. Hartwell noted the FBI had identified QAnon as a potential terrorist threat. How could she serve in this position, he asked, when it seems you represent none of the values we stand for as a community, or even more importantly, as Americans? There was a brief silence. Thank you. Okay, next, said the moderator, moving on to a question about vaccinations. Today, Facinello, who did not respond to requests for comment, remains in her post, but Hartwell isn't giving up. I think for these far-right conspiracists or radicals to be infiltrating the most basic unit of American government on an elected level, that's just really disturbing to me, he says, and they just sort of get away with it. It is not only happening in Grand Blanc. From Michigan to California and Las Vegas to rural Washington State, dozens of recently elected local officials have promoted elements of the outlandish internet conspiracy theory that views former President Donald Trump as a messianic figure, battling a cadre of deep state operatives, Democratic politicians, and Hollywood celebrities who molest and murder children. It is a symptom of how widely the QAnon delusion has spread in the U.S. In December, an NPR Ipsos poll estimated one in three Americans believed in some of the key tenets of the extremist ideology. Another survey by the conservative American Enterprise Institute found 29% of Republicans agreed Trump has been secretly fighting a group of child sex traffickers that include prominent Democrats and Hollywood elites. On Facebook alone, QAnon groups amassed millions of members before they were shut down, according to an internal company audit in August. At least two dozen Republican candidates who embraced the conspiracy ran for congressional seats in 2020. Two of them won, Lauren Boebert of Colorado and Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, who had falsely claimed Hillary Clinton murdered children and political opponents, dismissed mass shootings as false flag operations, suggested California wildfires were sparked by space lasers and voiced support for the execution of prominent Democrats. Since Trump's defeat, the QAnon movement has quietly entered a different and arguably more dangerous phase. Adherents now hold local elected offices across the U.S., from mayors to city council members to school board trustees, with the power to shape policies that directly affect the lives of millions of Americans, from positions that offer a measure of credibility to delusional beliefs. In some places, like Grand Blanc, the election of QAnon believers to local office has met little organized resistance. In others, it's prompted street protests, frantic PTA meetings, tearful city council Zoom calls, and hundreds of angry emails and petitions. It's impossible to estimate how many elected officials believe in QAnon or have promoted its theories in the past. No organization keeps tallies, and it can be hard to parse the point where Trumpian provocation ends and true conspiracy thinking begins. But it is clear from more than two dozen interviews with residents of communities where QAnon-tied officials or QAnon-tied officials have taken office that America's only beginning to grapple with the havoc that the cult-like conspiracy theory has wrought. Almost every resident who talked to Time about their own local officials' links to the movement also pointed out others in the area they had noticed sharing QAnon content, a state legislator, a county commissioner, a sheriff. The long-term impacts are really dangerous, says Jared Holt, a disinformation researcher at the Atlantic Council. We are supposed to have our leaders make decisions based on shared sets of facts. If we decide that for elected officials to believe in an outlandish Byzantine conspiracy theory like QAnon is okay, then the door is effectively left open for that shared sense of understanding to further erode. There's a photo here on this page of a young man seated at a table with a computer screen open and showing something on it with text and a graphic. He's dressed in dark colors. He's seated on a dark-colored wooden chair at a dark-colored wooden table. There are wooden blinds on the window behind the computer screen. He has well-groomed auburn hair, dark eyes. He's looking directly into the camera lens, but he's not smiling. It's Lucas Hartwell, a senior at Grand Blanc Community High School, in the room he uses as his workspace in Grand Blanc, Michigan. The QAnon conspiracy first took shape on fringe online message boards in 2017, when an anonymous poster claiming to be a high-ranking U.S. government official began to post cryptic messages about Trump's alleged crusade against the deep state cabal. The poster went by Q, a reference to a high level of government security clearance. A growing number of followers came together to attempt to decode Q's posts, which spun together a dizzying array of old and new conspiracies. Followers believed Trump's secret war would culminate in the storm, an event in which he would finally unmask his enemies and bring them to justice. But it was in the chaos of the past year that the movement drew widespread recognition. Conspiracies prey on people's fears, and fear was everywhere in 2020, of the coronavirus, of civil unrest, of government overreach, of a stolen election. All these fears were absorbed into the QAnon universe and amplified by powerful voices, including Trump himself. Over the course of the pandemic, the president retweeted QAnon-linked accounts more than 200 times, according to a tally kept by Media Matters for America, a liberal nonprofit group. Many of Trump's allies were even more explicit. Last summer, his son Eric posted a giant Q and the conspiracy's rallying cry, "Where we go one, we go all," on Instagram. When pressed, the president refused to disavow the movement, calling its followers people that love our country. It was a message he would echo January 6, when his supporters, many of them inspired by QAnon, stormed the U.S. Capitol in a violent assault that left 5 people dead. Trump's defeat was a turning point for many true believers of QAnon. Some were shattered by Joe Biden's ascension. Others were driven to take matters into their own hands rather than trust the plan for Trump to save them, as Q had long promised. Wondering when we're going to realize what's really happened blatantly in front of our eyeballs and start making moves locally, one poster wrote on a QAnon message board in January. Another urged fellow patriots to begin with city councils and school boards, to not just hold the line but make some headway into local governments. In fact, it was already happening. A wave of local officials with QAnon ties was elected in November, shaking up communities across the country. In Las Vegas, Katie Williams, 30, was elected to the 7-member board of the Clark County School District, which is the 5th largest in the country, with more than 300,000 children. A former Miss Nevada who claimed she was stripped of her title in 2019 because of her conservative views, Williams shares the former president's penchant for provocation. The pageant says it's because she broke its no politics rule for social media. On her Twitter account, she has called COVID-19 the China virus, belittled transgender athletes, and gone viral for taunting prominent Democrats. Williams has also been nicknamed #Q80 by her local critics for a slew of posts laced with QAnon conspiracies. Wayfair is selling children, and if you don't believe that, you're probably voting for Joe Biden, she tweeted last July, one of several posts amplifying a preposterous theory that the online retailer was trafficking children inside cabinets. Mandating masks are only helping child sex traffickers get away and hide, she tweeted a day later, another popular QAnon talking point. Williams wants to be the next Marjorie Taylor Greene, and this is how she's capitalizing on it, says one Las Vegas mother who requested anonymity because her child attends school in Williams' district. Parents who've pressed Williams about her statements said she either ignored their questions or blocked them on social media, accusing them of being bullies. Discussions about Williams' beliefs on a local parent's Facebook group grew heated, with some community members dismissing criticism of her conspiracy posts as partisan censorship. Williams' critics concede she's been adept at channeling many parents' frustration with how schools have handled the pandemic. There are far more people who agree with her enough on other issues that they are willing to not question her on the conspiracies, a second Las Vegas parent says. Other parents and local education officials say it has been challenging to untangle Williams' support for fringe conspiracies from her broader political activism. While she was running for the seat, a Zoom interview with the Clark County Parents Facebook group was dominated by questions about her social media posts. Parents argued she was putting local families in danger by assailing the China virus as anti-Asian hate crimes spiked in Las Vegas. With an American flag behind her, Williams spoke in measured tones, promising to respect diversity and casting her posts questioning the coronavirus as satirical. Her posts spreading QAnon theories, which have not been deleted, were meant to be taken as a joke, her spokesman, Noah Jennings, tells Time. Rebecca Dirks-Garcia, the president of the Nevada PTA and one of the administrators of the parents' Facebook group, suspects Williams is courting attention to elevate her political profile. She notes the discrepancy between Williams' professional behavior at board meetings and her tirades on Twitter. "If you talk to her one-on-one, she is not crazy," says Dirks-Garcia. "She'll be at a board meeting, she'll conduct herself appropriately, and then in the middle of the meeting she sends off this crazy tweet and you're like, what the?" Dirks-Garcia believes Williams' role on the school board is clearly as a stepping stone for bigger political aspirations. To many parents, this is hardly comforting. If she knows that these conspiracy theories are not true, I feel like that makes it worse, says Jennifer Kilkenny, 39, a digital marketing specialist who has two children in the Clark County school system. "This is my kids' education. This is a serious job." To conclude this abridged, lengthy article, for now, those conspiracy theorists remain in charge of everything from children's education to city budgets to the livelihoods of members of the community. Ava Butsu, an English teacher in Grand Blanc, said many faculty members had been aware of Amy Facinello's QAnon posts, but kept quiet out of fear for their jobs. "Everybody was terrified to speak at that first meeting," says Butsu, who thanked Hartwell, the high school senior, for being the only person brave enough to call her out. "Every time Americans choose not to speak out, they are ceding territory to conspiracy theories," she says. "It is a battle of inches." We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919 832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.